and just can't know. And so it's really hard. It's very difficult.
Were you at TPI for Thanksgiving?
Yes,
as
I
well?
Was. For me, I really didn't care for it much. It's an environment that people should experience. I suggest that anyone who wants to understand what it's like, you know, come in and spend a weekend. You'll see what it's like to be cooped up with 90-plus people who you don't know, some you don't care to know, as you stated, with all the little quirks and beats and bells and whistles that go along with it. And the holidays just make it even worse because everyone starts talking about things they didn't do or did do over the years and their family celebrated, which makes it even worse. So, mm-hmm. The next 2 weeks are going to be real, not say hard, but I'm going to have to kind of keep myself in check because I can lose my composure rather quickly.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's also, you know, the A&D, the alcohol and drug issues that, I mean, for me, that the drug issue was an issue for me, which is why I'm in the situation I'm in right now. I mean, it's situational, but it is a situation. It kind of makes you, you know, want to go out and use and drink and that sort of thing because you're so depressed for being, you know, in this location. And, you know, the majority of people don't want to be there. There are those that we jokingly call the mission technicians who, you know, as soon as the first raindrop falls, they run for cover and stay there until it gets nice and back out on the spring. So, you know, I mean, there's those that choose to be there. There's those that are thankful that, you know, this avenue is there and it's taken advantage of, I would imagine, the correct way. And there's some, you know, that just use the system as in any kind of situation like this.
Well, one of the things I always thought, and, you know, in the full disclosure, 13 years ago, I was working at Transition Projects, both on Thanksgiving and on Christmas for two consecutive years. And one of the things I always thought is strange is, you know, on one level, it's very appropriate, you know, but particularly, you know, Louis, you were saying for you, but part of what brought you to homelessness was the experience of drug and alcohol. So we want the shelters, you know, for that reason to have that clean and sober environment. And yet, if you have your own home at this season, you could get drunk as a skunk at your own kitchen table and nobody's going to say boo. So it's a strange thing because in some ways, you know, drinking to excess is almost part of the American holiday. So I'm not saying it should be or it's the best part, but it's a reality.
It's not so more of a reality. There, such as myself, you say reality. I'm there because I transitioned from one place to another and I found myself here. And I'm grateful for the situation that TPI and the Clark Center both have. It allows me to get acclimated to Portland society, learn my way around town, and also able to accommodate enough funds and staying together to move into society. So I really don't have an issue with the drug and alcohol problem. I went through all that stuff years ago, and I've gotten past it. But you still have people, such as he said, they come and they go, they manipulate the system, mm-hmm. their revolving door, and which makes it hard for people who are trying to do the clean and sober Christmas, mm-hmm. trying mm-hmm. to do the right thing, get through the holidays, because they see it, and the first thing comes to their mind, well, he did it, I can do it too, and it's over and over and over type thing.
Yeah, and I think that really gets to the next point. We've touched on it a little bit, but I want to expand on it, which is the fact that you're sharing the space with 95 other people, you know. Nice. And so everybody's coming with their own baggage, their own story, some of which might be very sympathetic, some might be as far off the map as you can imagine. Talk a little bit how the tensions can sometimes build up when you have so many people with their own competing interests.
Well, you know, I think for me, like we did touch on this earlier before we got on the air, and that is, you know, I'm very obsessive about a clean bathroom and, you know, clean shower and a clean kitchen. You would think that the men and the age of some of these men that are in this place, you know, once you get done eating something, you pick it up and you take it to the kitchen or take it to the bus stop. Like my mother always said, don't come in this kitchen, boy, empty-handed. These guys think their mother lives there, and I'm not that person, you know, but I can't stand, you know, a dirty bathroom. I can't stand a dirty kitchen. So, you know, I find myself, you know, cleaning, you know, the kitchen and the bathroom when I'm not. And we're supposed to do chores there. Mm-hmm. You do 2 hours of chores a week, and that's your duty. But you can't get some of these guys to do 2 hours and 1 minute more than they're supposed to. You know, so I don't mind cleaning. I like cleaning because I like to have a clean bathroom and a clean kitchen. But, you know, to see some of these guys not pick up after themselves, I mean, that's just basic common sense. That's what you do. And especially in a place like this where there's 90 other people, mm-hmm. 90 plus other people, and it's not going to clean itself. So somebody's got to do that, and they don't realize that you have to work together to keep this place somewhat clean.
Well, and to just react to what you're saying for a second, my partner, who she may be home listening tonight, hello, Lori, I think she probably like, well, I wish that Mike would pick up his plate every time he's done eating. But the difference is only one of me for her to deal with. There's not 94 of me to deal with.
For me, I'm going to rules. If you tell me don't turn that light, okay, I won't turn that light. There was an incident at TPI where I was asked to clean the bathrooms. And I only know one way to do it, and that's the right way. And it takes time to do it the right way. People can change. They kept coming in, coming out. And that rubs me. You know, the rules are rules. And I don't like them as anybody else. I've broken up a bunch of them myself. And it's funny that they want to adhere to them. They'll mm-hmm. find ways to get around them. Mm-hmm. They'll push them to the limit. They'll whatever it takes not to do what they're supposed to do, they'll do. Such as not being neat, not even their own personal selves. But then in the long run, it's like, oh, no, that's not right. Well, come on. You didn't follow the rules to start with.
Mm-hmm. So. And I think some of that falls on, you know, some of the staff at, you know, the two locations that I've been in. I think they could be a little more aggressive in their approach to you know, making sure that these things get done the way they're supposed to. And I know that, you know, for those people that are listening at TVI and the Clark Center, I'm probably going to get the wrath. But, you know, the reality is we all need to work together and make this place as comfortable as possible. This morning, you know, there's an issue with the television. There's a television there. Normally there's movies that are played basically 24/7. And, you know, when I get up, I want to see what's going on, you know, in the world. In Portland, the weather, as you know, the weather changes every 5 minutes around here. And so, you know, there was an issue with, you know, the television usage. I wanted to watch the news or have the news on in the morning at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. And this other person wanted to watch movies that they've been watching all night long. And, you know, I don't know if that's normally wouldn't give me any kind of, you know, my back wouldn't be up in a normal situation. But I think, you know, attributing to the holidays, probably, yeah, that has a lot to do with it. Because I don't like being where I am. I mean, I would like to be, you know, with family, with partner, with whatever, but not 94 people that I don't really know. So, you know, it is very tense. It's very tense, and, you know, it's understandable, and we all try to do the best we can. But, you know, sometimes tempers do get flared. There's no fights or anything, but there's, you know, some harsh words said back and forth, but that's being a guy.
One of the things that that I noticed from my time when I was working in the shelter was that around the holidays, in particular, from a little bit before Thanksgiving, really all the way through the Christmas holiday, mm-hmm. that you would have, you know, every night there's groups of volunteers who very thankfully come in and bring food. Well, that food's always good. That's what, but that's not what we're talking about tonight. What we are saying is what I always would notice is if it was a group of four people that would come in October, if that same group comes in December, is 24 people. And which, again, I'm not, you know, I think it's coming from a good motive. It's the holidays. People want to reach out. But one of the things that always drove me a little bit crazy is, boy, if we had the same outpouring of compassion, if you will, year round, I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yes, it would be nice if it was year round, but personally, you need them more involved in just bringing a meal. You need them there for people who want to work. They want a job. They want an education. They want to learn more about what's going on, health issues. I'm more than sure a lot of those people who come there to donate the time to prepare a meal have either themselves or have contacts with people who can help these gentlemen further along in their quest to get out of a homeless situation. If it makes them feel good serving the food, great. But if you can teach a person, you can feed a person all the time. But if you teach that person how to feed themselves, mm-hmm. then they won't be back. Mm-hmm. They need the skills further than just the meal. Because it's the one thing, you know, you eat at 6 o'clock at 6:30.
Right.
Well, I think, you know, and it's great that volunteers do come in and do the food thing every night and bring in just a plethora of clothing. I remember when I first got there around October, you know, the clothes were coming in. There's a clothes closet that TPI, as you know, opens up to the general population of homeless people from 2:30 to 3:30. They can come in and the men can come in and take showers and that sort of thing. And then the guys that stay at TPI after 3 have the ability to go in and you know, check out the clothes that are there. That's wonderful. I noticed that, you know, there was a few coming in when I first got there. November, there were so many things, so many bags of clothes that came in that, you know, it was hard to keep up on getting them on the racks and everything. That, I would think, needs to continue past January 1 when, you know, the four network stations around here stop airing those PSAs about bringing, you know, clothes to the shelters and that sort of thing. I mean, that needs to just continue on.
But I was also interested in, Don, some of the points that you were making about what I would call maybe a deeper level of commitment and assistance. I mean, again, bringing the clothes, bringing the food, it's definitely has its role. It definitely fills a certain need. But, yeah, oftentimes I would think, because you would see these great resources, clearly oftentimes it was church communities mm-hmm. getting their members to turn out, again, which I really appreciate people taking the time during the evening. But if you think, if you could harness that same energy, say, for instance, to host, you know, to take in 10 men and help them connect with local employment opportunities or...
Yeah, I mean, they could actually don't have to take them in. They could actually stay either at TPI or at Clark or any other facility that has to accommodation to housing men. But they need that information. You know, information is free, but it's hard to get if you just don't know where to go get it. I can speak for myself. And if I was, say, from your town, Boston, I have no problem getting information. I know my way around Boston. I lived in Maryland a while. I learned my way around. I know information there. I got to Portland, and getting information in Portland is a little unique than I've been in some other states. They will give you enough, but it's not what you ask for because you don't get specific. If you ask a general question, you get general information. So you need someone to guide you through the quagmires, the backwaters of trying to just get your ID. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's ways of getting around not having a birth certificate. There's ways of getting around not having all those documents. But you're not told that. Because those documents can be found. You can do that online. But how many men in those situations have access to the computer that much time, know what websites to go to, what to download, what to ask for, have a place it's sent to? So, yeah, if someone out there who can do that type of thing, by all means, come in, you know. Donate a few minutes.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also, you know, there's again, with 94 people in a dorm situation that, again, you don't know, there's a lot of cultural disconnects, if you will, that are there. There's a lot of men that have never been around other men to begin with. There's certainly men that have never been around African-American men. There's men that not have been around, you know, Native Americans or Hispanics. And so I think, you know, that comes into play also, and that can also make things a little tense as well.
So one of the other things that during the holidays that I noticed would happen is sometimes there would be, you know, like carolers and such coming in, which it's a little early for Christmas, and you guys probably haven't seen that, but it's something that I saw a couple different years, and it had a really mixed response. For some people, they felt thrilled. Oh, there's people coming in, they're singing the carols. Other people were like, you know, this is where I live right now, and I don't know if I want to hear 20 people singing happy songs. I don't feel so happy. What?
Well, you know, I I agree that it can throw someone who is trying to deal with depression issues anyway, you know, deeper into, you know, higher doses of Zoloft or something, you know. it can be very depressing. And at Thanksgiving, you know, you start seeing those commercials on television about, you know, all the great Christmas presents and shopping and all this kind of thing. And joy, 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 happy, 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 and all that. But it's very depressing. It's very depressing, you know, looking around and seeing, you know, bunks as far as you can see. And you know, it's just not fun.
Yeah, it's not fun. I mean, I could, careless one way or the other, I wouldn't mind. I kind of put it back on the power that be to make that call, whether or not they would allow the carolers to come in. If they did allow them to come in, take it a step further, say, well, anyone who doesn't wish to participate, you know, would you please, you know, go off here or step in here, whatever situation. Like Louis said, it gets to be real hard sometimes to keep attitudes in check, keep comments in check. Some people, they dwell on the confusion. Mm-hmm. The more confusion, mm-hmm. the better off it is for them, because that way they get to blend in and do less or don't do anything at all. So this time of year for some people is a joyous time for some. And this time of year for some people, it's a way not to have to deal with anything else at all. It's their escape. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's also, you know, there's not only just a homeless issue for whatever reason. There's some transitioning people that have been incarcerated as well. And so, mm-hmm. you know, some of that, you have to take that in consideration as well. Some of those guys that come from being incarcerated, they sometimes do the things that they did while they were in jail. And this is not the place to be doing that.
Right. No, that was a dynamic that I would see too, is that you would have people coming out of a very hard institutional information where the ropes that they had learned to get by were, again, a high level of manipulation, often for self-survival. I mean, I don't want to cast too much judgment, but what it meant was, you talk about some really rough, conniving characters coming into a room full of other people, with their own agenda, and there was times that I saw that play out with the nasty group dynamic.
I mean, you got hardcore dynamics there. You got some that are so soft and so subtle. It's like stroking a baby's cheek. They're so subtle in what they do. Mm-hmm. You have some who, I call them whiners. They always whine. They're looking for the pity pat on the shoulder. You get some that are just straight out manipulators. Mm-hmm. You see them coming in the door. You got somebody just so arrogant that you just want to reach out and touch them. You're so arrogant. So it plays from one extreme mm-hmm. to the next.
Yeah, right.
And like I say, it's when things start getting a little bit too much, then it might be a problem. Some things get said and. But I haven't seen any blows at it yet.
No.
I've seen a lot of noise.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, like I said, I'm thankful that TPI and Clark Center are there. You know, those avenues are available to people that are homeless. You know, but around the holidays, it is tough. It's depressing. It's emotional at times. You know, not to mention, you know, when you're in your bunk, and it's an open room, as you know, and, mm-hmm. and boy, the hog calls or something else, I'm telling you. I mean, there's a lot of wood that's being chopped at night.
But I guess for me, I mean, I think I would really and probably enjoy Christmas more if I had a closet.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really miss a closet. I think it really one way to kind of get through Christmas for a lot of people, even myself, if you just had that one little thing mm-hmm. that you could kind of get around. Mm-hmm. For me, it would be a closet. I don't know, anybody else might be something else, but a closet would really make me happy.
Well, I'm just, you know, just for me, just getting through the holidays would be good. I hope that just things just go well. You know, I mean, it's the tension's always going to be there. I just, you know, and I'm going to still clean like I always do. But I hope you do. I just hope that some of these guys just start picking things up and making it easier for for those of us that do the cleaning in the place.
Well, I think we are about to take a musical break. Before we go to the musical break, we're going to switch subjects when we come back. I'm going to have both Louie and Don in the studio, and then we're going to be joined by Ian Todd, and we're going to switch our topic. We're going to talk about the city of New Orleans and a place where many people who consider themselves New Orleans residents are not going to be home for the holidays, and we're going to move into that. So this is a musical break. This is Ali Fakatori, instrumental.
Atallaji bi non mo bayka sanda alhasidi terina ci hayno kaga bayinte
Welcome back. You are listening to 90.7 KBOO FM. This is Michael Anderson, and you're listening to the Hole in the Bucket Show. I'm joined in the studio by Louie Smith and Don Johnson, and hopefully by phone with Ian Todd. Ian, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Excellent. Ian, thank you very much for coming on to our show. For this last portion of the show, we are going to revisit a subject that we have covered several times on Hole in the Bucket Show, which is the recovery from Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans.
Actually, I lost you one moment.
Can you hear me? Okay. Sounds like we're having a little bit of trouble with Ian. Maybe it's on his end. But I'm going to keep talking, and then Ian's going to jump in a second here. The long and short of it is that here we are now a year and a half after that horrible storm, and we've seen still many of the residents, particularly the residents without a lot of affluence, unable to go back to the place that they formerly knew as home. And with that sort of as a segue, I'm going to go back to Don, who's been with us for the first half of the show, and talk a little bit about that's part of what brings you here to our city, Portland.
Correct. I evacuated when Katrina came in and spent better part of most of last year in Maryland, and returned to New Orleans, general area, got a job and was working, but I didn't care for a lot of the things that was going on. The relationship I was in basically got even strained because we had two conflicting thoughts about what was going on with the situation, with the influx of people who was coming from Orleans Parish into the outer neighboring parishes with their attitudes, the lot of things they were used to doing, their gangness. So I just thought it would be better for me to exit stage left to some place where I can regroup.
One of the things that we focused on the show, I mean, there's so much that you could talk about in terms of Katrina. I think it's one of those events that shows so much about who we are as a country, who we are as a society, who New Orleans is as a city, the whole affected area, how it played out. Specifically on the show, with the focus being housing and homelessness, we particularly been interested in those who used to live in New Orleans who the hurricane became an excuse to maybe get them out. Can you talk a little bit more about?
But they figured, they worked the numbers, and they figured that half the people that left will not come back. And out of the half that came back, a third would probably leave again. And those are some rough numbers they were throwing around in the beginning just because they had seen a better way of life. A lot of people lived in public housing, which was very much substandard or below standards. They had very, very low-paying jobs. Most of them were in the hotel, motel industry, service jobs, weren't paid very well, not much health care. So Katrina, for some, was a blessing to be taken to another state, another area, exposed to different things, learning about a different way of life. For some, it was so traumatic, they don't know what else to do but Louisiana.
Ian, are you with us?
I can hear you just barely.
All right. Well,
that's better.
Okay, good. So I had just begun talking with Don, a former resident in New Orleans himself who's up here. Why don't, as a way of background, we have you on the line, why don't you give a little bit of background about your connection to New Orleans?
Well, I had been to New Orleans previously before the storms came to the Gulf region, but I was living and in Portland when Katrina hit, and I went through the Red Cross training at the Child Services Center, which they used as a shelter here in Portland. The American Red Cross in Portland did for about 20 residents of New Orleans who had been displaced, and was put on their deployment list. And about 6 weeks later, they called me and asked me if I was still available to go to New Orleans. And so they sent me down originally for 3 weeks, and then after I was there 3 weeks, they offered to put me on staff if I was willing to stay in the area for at least 3 months working with them. So that's how I wound up there.
One of the things that Don was talking about, I believe where you were in limbo, is and where I would like to sort of take this before, is I think what Don was talking about was that New Orleans prior to Katrina hitting still had a lot of the poverty and struggles and challenges that became highlighted to the nation once Katrina hit. But that was something that was already part of the New Orleans reality beforehand. And in fact, my understanding is, did you do some work around the I-10 Causeway?
Yeah, that was definitely an experience we had. I mean, because we were providing essential services in a lot of cases to people who were already needing some sort of social assistance before Katrina and Rita ever came, either through welfare or other programs, or in some cases they were, you know, homeless or homeless part of the year, and then all those basic services were literally blown away. So, which meant that a normal Red Cross operation is maybe 3 weeks at the most. And we were there providing meals and providing our services for upwards of 8 months. Because the social fabric was already, in a lot of cases, especially in the southeast end of New Orleans, was already frayed, and there was a lot of need before there was a storm.
What part of I-10 were you at on that service road area?
Did you hear that, Ian?
No, I couldn't.
What part of I-10 were you on in that I-10 causeway area?
I was actually, I got there right as the waters from Rita finally dried up, and so I was actually on the north shore, on the north side of the lake, at my office originally, and then I was working sheltering volunteers in Orleans Parish and Jefferson Parish, which is on the south side of the lake and is what we think of as New Orleans proper. And then I was down in the central business living in the central business district and working out of Algiers Point, but we were distributing meals all through, all the way from the south end of Plaquemines Parish, which is 100 miles away, to St. Bernard and New Orleans East and the Lower Ninth Ward and Gentilly and the stuff along the lake on the north side. So I was all over the area, but I was actually sheltered in the Central Business District for most of the time I was there.
Yeah, well, along a lot of other the caregivers were down there also. Myself, I come from the West Bank. I'm about an hour out of Lower Plaquemines, around Boothville, that area. I can be there for my home. I can be there in like an hour by drive. So it was pretty devastating. Past the Empire Bridge along that area, it was real bad.
One of the things that I'm interested in getting, Dom, both your comments and Ian, you as well, is we've heard a lot, particularly around the public housing that abuts right up on the French Quarter, mm-hmm. and that in many ways that this storm has provided an excuse or a vehicle to remove that housing because of its optimum location, if you will. What are your observations around that? Is that indeed what's going on?
There wasn't anything as far as priorities about any work of restoring it. When I got there, there were none. Everything was very much in sort of a Band-Aid mode. And as the plans went forward, and the opportunity to working in the sort of the Central Disaster Resource Area for a few weeks, which is where the city and the state and the federal agencies all have that. Yeah, those projects along Rampart there on the north side of the quarter, they were in disrepair. There was a high level of, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it was a really high level of unemployment, and in a lot of cases, my gut feeling is that the local agencies felt that being shuttered by the storm was, in some cases, a blessing, because those were, in a lot of cases, problematic or blighted properties.
Well, growing up in it, not in that particular area, but I used to work in one of the restaurants in that area, and majority of people that work in the CBD and the French Quarter, along Canal Street, some parts of Rampart, live in those by the projects, because they don't have the transportation mode. A few years back, there was a big push to regenerate that whole area, and those projects basically stopped it. The quarter can't grow any further because of the projects, so, and there's a lot of new money coming in that area. So your gut feeling was pretty much right. In my opinion, it's been right for years. They didn't have an excuse to close it down.
Touched on an interesting, and well, because a lot of those people didn't have vehicles, and the people who lived east of the quarter as well, which is where the lower ninth ward is and the upper ninth, a lot of those people didn't have vehicles or only maybe had one for a large family, because, and they were able to do that in large part because the mass transit system there was similar to Portland's, and it was cheap and it was effective and it was fast, and the buses came all the time, and so it was possible to live there and go about your life without a vehicle. And so when the storm came, people weren't able to leave.
And also, this is like my opinion again, the city itself is always dependent on tourism for their livelihood. Once you get out of the city area and start going into the suburbs around Metairie, Kenner, out by the airport, that's more industrialized. Yeah. You got the chemical plants, a few other the major plants in the area. But the city itself would not bring in any major players to bring in any meaningful jobs. They only want to keep that flavor of the city, which you keep hearing so much about, which meant they didn't need a lot of a large educated workforce. So, and then the government itself was always run by two or three particular families mm-hmm. for years, which meant my family's in power today, so-and-so is in charge of this. Basically, the school system went down. Fire department went down. The police went down. Because family members controlled it.
Yeah, there's a real lock on a lot of that. And you're right. I think there's one Fortune 500 company with a headquarters in New Orleans proper. And you're definitely right as far as the number of businesses that that require something more than just a basic skill set, and therefore a lot of the people in New Orleans who are, you know, wage hour employees, you know, that job's gone, and they don't have the resources to fix up the family home because, you know, they don't have the same kind of money that somebody who was more, I mean, or someone who's college educated and working a white collar job is more likely to have. And the people who work those jobs were more likely to be in places where they were flooded out.
Did you ever come in contact with any FEMA representatives while you were down?
The representatives of whom?
FEMA.
FEMA, yeah. I worked with FEMA quite a bit. FEMA supplied our water and a lot of our supplies that the Red Cross then distributed, or was our resource for finding vendors for truck parts and the supplies we needed to keep our fleet running. And then I actually got to know some of the FEMA administrators who dealt more at the ground level with the community level as far as what do people need in this neighborhood, that kind of service providing. I got to know them really well.
Yeah, because I see a FEMA as something that could be actually could go away, be redone, and maybe come back in 20 years. They might get it right.
Yeah, the vast majority of people that I met from FEMA on the ground were great and were dedicated and hardworking, had volunteered to be there. In a lot of cases, were people like me or my coworkers who had actually started with another volunteer agency, and because they were there, moved into those because they needed people who were familiar with the conditions, which was a good thing, but. There was a lot of frustration from everyone about the decisions that were made in Washington, D.C. and in Baton Rouge about how things were going to be done. And we see now a federal court actually just ordered FEMA to start paying for hotel rooms and apartments again for people who evacuated.
One of the things that
they're reinstating the payments. So
that's good. That's good news. One of the things I haven't understood, and maybe I'm not sure where the perspective with this would come from, but first of all, let me say, Ian, I think it's a wonderful thing that you went down there and volunteered, and it makes sense that they would look for folks like yourself to put into paid positions. But one of the things that I wonder is why weren't people who were there put into the paid positions to be part of the help staff, or was that going on?
Michael, could you give me the question again? I could hear just part of it.
Okay. What my question was is, as you were saying, that in some ways that yourself and some of the other people that you became familiar with down there had come as volunteers and then were taken in into paid positions because they were looking for people to help with the recovery efforts. And one of the questions that I have is I wonder what efforts were made to use some of those same employment opportunities for people who were from the area?
There were some that I know that were from the area who did. We had people that we called local, that you call locally deployed volunteers, someone who's from there and decides to help with the Red Cross. So we had people who were actually, you know, we don't like to use the word victims, but evacuees, victims of the storm, and kind of situation. And some of them did wind up working in those situations. And also, I worked with a lot of the city and social agency employees who were being housed on the cruise ships because they had lost their homes and were still working. But I don't. One of the problems with extending those opportunities to people is, in a lot of cases, those people who were from there were in Houston and they were in Dallas and they were in Birmingham and they were in Atlanta, and they weren't there.
Yeah, but also when those people wanted those jobs, they told them, "Well, no." Basically, I was in Maryland, and they had people recruiting people at the college level. Come down, be a volunteer, work there, earn X number of dollars per hour. And I'm saying, well, why are you doing this when you got a whole gym at the Armory there in D.C. with people that come from there?
Yeah.
It's about dollars and cents. They didn't want them there because then they couldn't justify those no-bid contracts.
Well, yeah, there's a combination of that or using, you know, even cheaper college labor in a lot of cases. I mean, and the college kids were great, but there is a certain level of, experience. And just, I mean, I was able to do what I did in part because I had the opportunity to try to become part of the community, and I had, you know, I was somewhat familiar with it beforehand. But, yeah, I mean, it would have been great to have more people who were actually from New Orleans and the parishes working with us more than we had, because in a lot of cases we didn't have people to ask questions of, or we had to hunt.
Because basically, I remember when they FEMA evaluated my grandma's home, the gentleman called me and he says, "Well, I need you here today." I said, "Well, I'm in Maryland. Mm-hmm. There's no way I'm going to get there today." He said, "Well, your claim is going to be denied." I said, "Well, why don't you basically give me a couple of days, I can make arrangements for the home to be seen." So basically, after some checking, I found out that this gentleman had a timeline. They were given X number of houses to see and turn in the paperwork. They weren't doing the work. They would wait till the last couple of days, make these bunch of phone calls, and then send all these rejection notices, and they were getting paid.
Yeah, that there's an agency. There's some really good people work for it, so I'm not going to name it, but there was an agency where, when we got back to the hotel we were living in, they always, with their vehicles, official vehicles, always had the best parking spots in front of the hotel and had obviously been at the bar for a number of hours. So you knew that they, you know, drove out, poked around for an hour or two, and then went back home. Yeah. And that went on. And there was a lot of problems with, you're talking about an insurance claim, there are a lot of problems with the bulldozing that people weren't getting. There wasn't enough time to locate people for them to be able to be notified to at least come and try to recover something from their homes.
Well, it goes back to the initial question. And that property, all the lower ninth from the Chalmette, Araby, mm-hmm. Miro into New Orleans is prime real estate. Because Orleans Parish needs a buffer. And they also need places for the city elite to live and also be close into the city, because New Orleans East is not as viable as it used to be, and the North Shore is getting crowded. Mm-hmm. So they only have one other direction to go. Is that either to Chalmette, that area, or go out toward Kenner and Metairie and mm-hmm. outward. So it was a situation that they needed something to happen. It happened through nature, but a lot of people have gotten taken to the cleaners. And it's all in the thing of, we need to do this for city and country. It's one of the slogans they were throwing around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. Go ahead, Ian.
And I was going to say, you bring up Chalmette and down there, and the interesting difference I did notice, and I think it just has to do with attitude maybe, I mean, it probably also has a little bit to do with community, that in New Orleans it was very much a neighborhood identity. You know, I'm from the Lower Ninth Ward, or I'm from Faubourg-Marigny, or, and in down in Chalmette and down there, it was very much a parish identity. And so people were much more willing, and I didn't feel as lost if they were having to move from one part to another, because they were still in St. Bernard Parish. And I think also just that the leadership down there, since the storm, has actually been a lot stronger and a lot more forthright and a lot more honest about what they're doing. So if people know that their neighborhood's going to be turned into a park, at least they know in time to be able to plan. And so the recovery there and has gone much more smoothly. But that prime real estate down there, the story I heard about the Lower Ninth Ward, and I heard it from several sources, was that a number of the cruise ship companies were really interested in the land right along the levee that broke.
Of course. It's right there by Missigo, with that area. And it's also, eventually, the Corps of Engineers is going to have to deepen the Industrial Canal, which means those cruise ships will be able to come in up the Industrial Canal behind, they come up along Jefferson Highway, up along the Jefferson Corridor, into the river again.
Mm-hmm.
So that cuts their trip out in half.
And in one sense, if you, like, that's the lowest, well, actually the lowest point in the area is actually in Kenner.
Right.
But that's the lowest area in Orleans Parish. Not Kenner, New Orleans East, because that's reclaimed swamp. But it's the lowest sort of where people have lived for a long time. And in some sense, it would be better if that was just some warehouses and industrial space, but you hate to see it on the backs of people's family homes.
Well, it's one of those opinion things. I mean, I know some people that live there all their life, they will never live anywhere else because that's where they settled. I've known some who've moved in there, and they love it. So it's an opinion thing. But my thing is, I'm not from Orleans Parish itself, per se. I'm an outsider, but they need to stop wanting everyone to support Orleans Parish. True enough, it's the bread and butter pretty much of the state, only because they do the tourism thing. But if they were to diversify, become part of the 21st century, and actually get companies there, teach the kids what to do, how to do it, and then it'll be a much better place.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. It's most of Orleans Parish is filled with residential, and there aren't places to work outside of the tourism areas in a lot of cases, which means that most of what flooded is housing. And New Orleans East is a perfect example. That's miles out to the east. That was all built post-war after it was drained of being a swamp, and it's pretty much wrecked by the storm surge from the lake. And there's some industrial stuff along the south side and down towards the NASA plant, but there's not a whole. There's a lot of empty space that isn't jobs. There's nothing. And now it's nothing again. And I mean, it's an accident of geography as far as them needing housing after World War II, but it's resulted in a place with not a lot of places to work now.
Well, we're always getting to this part in the show where it seems like the conversation's just getting going and it really is heating up. Unfortunately, we do have to wrap up for this evening. Ian, thank you so much for being on. I'm sorry for the technical difficulties when you first
called
in.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And then also, Don and Louis, thank you very much for being on KBOO this evening. We really appreciate it. I'm going to leave us with a note to close out on, which is on December 21st, which is Thursday. There is the Homeless Memorial, which is in the outside in courtyard at 6 p.m., it's a recognition of the homeless people who are homeless who have passed away here on the streets in the last year. So if you want more information, call Street Roots 503-228-5657. This has been Michael Anderson and Hole in the Bucket 90.7 on your FM dial and community radio, KBOO FM. Have a good evening and keep on rocking.